I mean, for us, the impact that we crave really is ecosystem restoration. And so this is the main goal of the organization. And it's the one thing that has been discussed on a weekly basis during our all hands. So where everyone in the team kind of sits together in a virtual meeting to discuss what are we doing. And so the two main KPIs are tell us something that is that has happened in the impact space, really. What have we created? What have we helped create? And then let's check what our monthly recurring revenue is. So yeah, we are continuously expanding our portfolio of impact partners that we want to work with or that we could work with all over the world, and hearing their stories and seeing what can happen when we manage to move money in their direction. That's really, yeah, that's the reason why we built this company. So for us, that's really the main driver of impact. So we got 3 million square meters of ecosystems restored. I think that was that milestone was hit last month.
Welcome to episode 164. My guest is Simon Schilbeck, founder and chief vision officer of Handprint, a nature tech on a mission to make nature positive actions simple, science-based, and engaging. So obviously, we discuss sustainability and how entrepreneurs can make a difference without breaking the bank. By weaving positive impact into the fabric of your business strategy, you not only contribute to a better world, but also enhance brand reputation, customer loyalty, and ultimately your bottom line. Simon, who is an academic, also shares his experience jumping from the university world into entrepreneurship, as well as the bottlenecks he's been facing along the way. Remember, there's a 100% chance you become the bottleneck in your business. It happens to all business founders, regardless of their experience or industry. So take the bottleneck index today. Discover your hidden bottlenecks and tackle them heads on. You'll find the link in the show notes. And now let's turn to the interview. Hi, Simon. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
So you are in Singapore. I am in Finland. It's 2 degrees today. I guess in Singapore it would be a bit hotter.
It is definitely a bit warmer here. But I just got back from Belgium, where it was probably like 5 or 6 degrees, and yes, I struggled with the cold.
So you are an academic. You've got a PhD in resource constraint innovation and knowledge recombination. I mean, just a title I don't understand. You were visiting assistant professor of innovation in Aalto University, actually in Finland, from 2018 to 2020. And you've been an assistant professor of strategic management since July 2016 at the Singapore Management University. How did you make the jump into the entrepreneurial world? I mean, I guess there must be like some big differences.
There are very big differences for sure. But yeah, it just came out of some of the academic research we were doing at the time in 2017, 2018. I was doing some research around innovation in the natural world, had a really good postdoc who had hired out of USC in California, who moved to Singapore to work on a variety of projects with me. And one of our projects was in Myanmar, where we did a case study on a mangrove restoration group called Worldview International. And after spending 6 days with them in the mangrove swamps, learning a lot about mangroves, my postdoc decided to set up a company to help them access international climate financing. And that was the first kind of step into entrepreneurship. And then about a year and a half later, we started working with Matthias, our CEO from Handprint. And yeah, we started working together. Collaboration went very well. And he convinced us to set up a second company after the first one to kind of scale some of the ideas and technology we'd been developing in the first one, which is a non-profit. And yeah, so somehow I got pushed into entrepreneurship by virtue of just doing research that kind of got out of hand.
Right. Oh, well, you know, was it hard, the move?
It is hard. And it's also not a move, right? It's really an adoption of an additional stream of work. So I'm still an academic. I still work at Singapore Management University. I'm now also a visiting professor at LUT in Finland instead of at Aalto. So, but the transition is very challenging in many ways because, yeah, entrepreneurship is really, really different from being an academic. And even though I teach business model innovation and do a lot of kind of entrepreneurship minded research with my students, when we work with corporate clients, doing it yourself and actually being a founder in a startup is, yeah, much harder than teaching it.
It's an interesting topic, at least for me, because I'm in contact with, as a startup mentor, I'm in contact a lot with teams that have a research background, an academic background like yourself. And they really struggle going into entrepreneurship. And most of the time, it's what I see is because they have difficulties to put themselves into put a business hat on. Do you agree with that? What would you recommend to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think given that I'm a professor in a business school, for me, putting the business hat on is a bit easier. But yeah, still, there are times where I think I still have the tendency to do too much for clients for free or just not charge enough, especially when they ask me to come speak at events and so on. I was like, oh, yeah, that's fun. We can do this and might be good exposure. But this might be good exposure doesn't mean money on the bank. And so I think there is a tendency for academics to kind of lack that willingness to kind of, yeah, just push the commercial side of it. Because of course we are trained in doing research and even we're paying to get our research published. So it's very different. We're trying to create knowledge for everyone, make it accessible to everyone. And of course, when you're in a startup, you have to think about this differently. And so that has created at times some interesting discussions and small conflicts between our CEO is more of a seasoned entrepreneur. And then the other two co-founders who are both kind of reforming academics, there are differences in approaches and got to find a middle ground that enables us to keep kind of our academic integrity, which is, I think, a big part of why we are also well-regarded as a company. So why we're credible, but at the same time also, continuously thinking about like, okay, how are we paying the bills at the end of the month? Because once you have a bunch of employees, of course, the mindset needs to shift.
Yeah. Yeah, and you just mentioned like that you know keeping your academic integrity, which is absolutely critical, but at the same time you're working in a for-profit industry, so you have to make money. And how can you always keep that integrity?
I would say yes, but it really, I mean, there's a separation of things that we do or that I do within the company where I'm more exposed and kind of involved in the thought leadership, the kind of the writing of thought pieces, and then of course sales conversations. And so I think within those types of activities, having that integrity is actually very useful, right? Mm-hmm. Because nobody wants to do business with someone they can't trust. And I think our academic background and our kind of qualifications also as kind of thought leaders in the space of on the intersection of digitization and sustainability are really helpful in our organization. But then when it comes down to, okay, we are now in the space where, let's say, the sales work has been done and people have been convinced, and now this needs to move towards a deployment phase where, kind of the invoices need to get paid and you need to start chasing people. Then luckily we have other people in the team that do this so that I don't, probably it's also not my talent, so there's not much point for me being involved in this. But I think it is really possible to do that. But of course, the level of detail in terms, when we're doing like thought leadership pieces, we've published quite a few and some have been very well received. But of course, the level of detail and the level of in-depth research that goes into a thought leadership piece for handprint is not comparable to the level of detail and research that goes into an academic publication. And so, I don't think that's lower integrity. It's just, it's a different audience. And so you write with a different mindset and you write with a very different goal. So, but so far it has not really been a massive issue, I would say.
Yeah, apparently, which is, this is good to hear. What are your current bottlenecks?
Like many startups that started just before the pandemic, as we did, we've only had bottlenecks. So, if you just think about
what, right?
If we just think about like the reality of the world since the end of 2019, where we initially had this horrifying pandemic, where people were unable to meet each other for the longest of time, and we started this company fully virtually, not being able to sit together and do brainstorms for the first 9 months, right? So that's already a big bottleneck. And then once we collectively as a world kind of started coming out of the COVID pandemic, we got to the war in Ukraine, and then more recently the war in Palestine. And so all of those things have really changed the risk profile and the risk appetite of investors, and not only of investors, but also of companies, right? So working with a startup is always a risk. Companies need to be willing to incur that risk because they believe in the potential of it. And I think this has been a massive, massive challenge for us. And the clearest way in which this manifests for us is extremely protracted sales cycles, where companies or the people we talk to in the company are totally on board and kind of love what we do and say, oh, this is great, we want to do something like this. And then it takes months or years before actually something happens. And so for us, the biggest bottleneck is really that, like, how do we shorten the very long sales cycles and move towards revenue recognition faster? Because if we can't solve that problem in the next 6 to 9 months, then we won't survive.
So do you have some hints on how you got to do that?
Part of it is to move towards a more narrow focus on a smaller set of target companies. The kind of challenge with what Handprint, so for those who don't know, is that so we are a platform that connects companies to the most impactful nonprofit organizations in the world and enables companies to integrate micro contributions to these organizations into a variety of business processes. And these business processes can be e-commerce, can be advertising, can be retail transactions, can be bank card transactions, can be money movement, can be CRM systems, and like everything. You can basically, any kind of KPI that you want to link to a credible commitment to do something good in the world, you can use Handprint technology to do that. And that gives us, in theory, an incredibly broad potential client base.
Yeah.
Which also means that we don't know who we serve, right? And so we recently made the very tough decision of kind of sunsetting our very first product, which was our e-commerce plugin. And as a consequence, had to say goodbye to about 150 customers, saying like, well, it's just, we're not going to be keeping the work to kind of keep this alive because it just doesn't create enough revenue. And so focusing more on specific sectors, which for us is going to be retail banking and potentially also other types of banking, is going to be very helpful, hopefully. Mm-hmm. The other thing we're doing is we're kind of moving from a direct sales model towards a channel sales model, so that we actually only really need to do one very long and complex sales conversation, but then the client then becomes the reseller of our technology. And if they can kind of leverage their existing relationships with their own customers, that will hopefully accelerate the ability for us to kind of move money towards impact all over the world. So these are the main things. So clearer definition of the ICP, more focus, and then and probably also just developing more and more practice. None of us in the team really comes from a sales background. So we're getting better at doing sales, and we're getting better at putting deadlines and telling customers, like, if you're not moving, we're not going to keep chasing you, so that we don't lose too much time on these conversations that might at some point in the future result in some kind of deal. Absolutely. And so that's what we're going to be focusing on.
Absolutely. This is a very typical bottleneck among startups, you know, not defining, not being precise enough about who your ideal customer is. And, you know, you've got a tendency to serve too many people or too many like segments.
Yeah,
and like you said, the problem is that by doing that, you also serve people that will never be really happy about you, and you will never be really. It's they are simply wrong
for you, for the type of, for your company, yep. for your company's culture, for the type of people you hire, and you waste time serving them while you should be spending more time finding the right people, those who will, you know, always be happy to buy your services. But that requires a shift in mindset.
Yeah, it just also requires, yeah, I think stronger leadership and basically telling the team, like, yeah, all of these conversations that are ongoing, we're not going to pursue this anymore. Let's focus on this and this and this that we know we can make work. And at the same time, also, I think we need to, because we're still a very small organization, we need to maintain some strategic flexibility to see, like, okay, if something comes our way and there's a real opportunity to create something that we think is a very scalable solution, even if it's not 100% aligned maybe with what we have in mind, that we can still have that either pivot or say, like, okay, we're hiring two extra people and we're going to build that as well because we have a paying client that wants this. And then, so yeah, I think we need to have both things. Like, you have the strong focus on what you're spending, like the resources, let's say, of your growth team, of your marketing, the kind of outward focus. At the same time, also remaining flexible for inbound requests. And I think finding that right balance is pretty challenging, especially for a product team.
Absolutely. Like you said, it requires strong leadership. It requires someone at the top saying, well, okay, guys, this is what we're going to do now. This is what we're going to focus on, and this is why we're doing it. But you can't have strong leadership without a change in mindset. Otherwise, you're the bottleneck.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Right. The best thing a founder or a CEO can do for the company is to make themselves not needed, right? That is, so if you can do this as an organization, yeah, I think it always becomes the issue for powerful leaders that they become the bottleneck themselves. So yeah, trying to find out ways to make yourself more and more useless without sacrificing, of course, the quality of output. I think it's an interesting challenge.
So absolutely. You had some challenges. You mentioned like COVID and the wars, but also when we first talked, you mentioned to me that, you know, it started with 3 co-founders, you went up all the way to 40 staff, down to 25, and you said to me that you grew too fast. Can you elaborate on that?
I think what we grew too fast in that, I think, given the revenue we have, and especially had, we were overly optimistic about our capacity to close deals at scale. And we were also, in the beginning, we've been very successful at fundraising. But so we had quite a lot of capital. And as a consequence, we had these very ambitious goals also, you know, discussed with the board, like in terms of how much we should grow, how much revenue we should create. And you can't even dream about getting those things, hitting those targets, if you don't have the team that actually is big enough to do so. And so we had that quite large and inflated team without, say, before we really had product market fit. And as a consequence, we've built a lot of things, and many of those things are very useful and we're still using, but we probably built too many different things.
Yeah.
Because we had that kind of capacity. We had the staff for it, and we had the different people that were also kind of saying, like, oh, I see this opportunity, let's kind of pursue this, and somebody else. And so we had this kind of very experimental mindset, like, we can try a variety of different things because we had the financial slack to do so. But then it turns out that the big project that we've been working on for a long time, and which should have been signed as a deal in August 2023, we're now in March 2024, and it still isn't signed. And that is, of course, really problematic. So, because we've built a lot of that specific technology for that partner, and the deal is still not finalized. And once it is finalized, it is going to be a very big deal, but it's been postponed and postponed. And again, on their side, it's probably the same kind of considerations, right? We are, they're facing the same kind of world we are facing. And as a consequence, their appetite to take risk, or their ability to take risk right now, is also more constrained. And so, Yeah, that's been the key challenge. And so, yeah, that means we've had to just cut people, and that's very painful.
Yeah.
And need to sanitize and kind of reduce the burn, because otherwise, there won't be anything left to burn.
And that's another interesting bottleneck you're raising here. So how long can you wait for a potential project to happen? When do you need the plug?
And I think that the answer to this is probably you wait too long because you're invested, right? And there's this kind of sunk cost fallacy that, like, we've done all of this work now and we've really, I mean, in our case with this one specific client, we've really put a lot of effort and resources into this.
Yeah.
And if this deal doesn't happen, yeah, then we need to completely reorient ourselves to something else. So I think you wait until the money runs out, right? And maybe then and even longer, you're probably still waiting on that deal. So there, and I think the key challenge there is also like, how do you negotiate with a partner from a position of strength? They're saying like,
yeah,
we, because we can deliver this. There's a lot of stuff that is that, I mean, they believe is like, if this partnership with us, they are going to be able to use this to grow their business significantly. So we need to maintain a position of strength, but at the same time, feeling that like that the longer and longer it takes, the more our backs against the wall. That's a really challenging act where, yeah, we need the CEO. And luckily I'm not the one that needs to do this. Our CEO is kind of managing this and it's like, yeah, well, you need to be able to, yeah, stay strong in the face of adversity and then just keep that relentless optimism, right? That's typical for entrepreneurs, that you need to be relentlessly optimistic that things will work out. And yeah.
But the problem is while you're doing that, waiting, you are maybe, you know, stuck in a situation and that prevents you from doing other things. So maybe perhaps a way of looking at it is shifting your mindset again. What would happen if you were pulling the plug today?
Yeah. And it's something that we are kind of, I mean, it's a scenario planning, right? So, and this is of course something that we're doing at the executive team at founder level, trying to figure out like, okay, let's take the worst case scenario. This deal is not happening. So what does that mean for what we are doing with our resources, how we allocate our time? And in the meanwhile, of course, what we've been doing is trying to pursue, of course, like every startup, you're pursuing other opportunities. We just signed a big contract with a large transport company, which is great. So other things are coming our way, but then again, not the perfect fit for what we're strategically kind of focusing on, but very well aligned with what our technology already can do. So there are these things that you need to do at the same time. Would it be better to just go back and say to this client, like, well, we're pulling the plug? Probably not. But giving them an ultimatum, that is definitely what's on the timeline for the next couple of months. Mm-hmm. We can't keep waiting for Godot to arrive.
No, you can't. Absolutely. You can't. All right, let's switch gear a little bit. Entrepreneurs crave impact. That's one of the reasons why they become entrepreneurs. What is the impact you create?
Oh, well, we have this very bold ambition that we want to win the Nobel Prize for Peace. So kind of inspired by Grameen Bank out of Bangladesh, Yunus also won the Nobel Prize. So, yeah. I mean, for us, the impact that we crave really is ecosystem restoration. And so this is the main goal of the organization. And it's the one thing that has been discussed on a weekly basis during our all hands. So where everyone in the team kind of sits together in a virtual meeting to discuss what are we doing. And so the two main KPIs are, tell us something that has happened in the impact space, really. What have we created? What have we helped create? And then let's check what our monthly recurring revenue is. And is that going up at the speed that it needs to go up in order to reach profitability by the end of the year? So these are the main things. And then, we are continuously expanding our portfolio of impact partners that we want to work with or that we could work with all over the world. And hearing their stories and seeing what can happen when we manage to move money in their direction, that's really, that's the reason why we built this company. So for us, that's really the main driver of impact. So we got 3 million square meters of ecosystems restored. I think that milestone was hit last month. Mm-hmm. So hope to be at 4 by the end of Q2 and then grow exponentially.
Yeah, that's a great impact. But you said Peace Nobel Prize. Yeah, why not, man?
It's an unconventional goal for a company, but it's, I think it's, And it's interesting. It's also a sales argument that we are, because we're in a couple of conversations with some very large companies. And there, one in specific, we can't disclose the name, but they're a large company in the payment space. And we told them, like, if you guys do what we suggest you can do, you will win the Nobel Prize in the next 5 years. Because you will become the biggest impact organization in the world. And there would be many, many reasons why you should get it. If you're really revolutionizing payments in such a way that every payment creates positive impact in the world, then yeah, that really becomes possible. And that's something fun. People don't really think about this, but it's like, well, that might be an argument for why they should take a chance on us and build that partners.
Continuing on the topic of impact and sustainability, I mean, this is clearly a hot topic at the moment, and there's a more and more pressure on companies and entrepreneurs.
Yep.
To be more sustainable. What are the simple things they can do to start the process, at least?
Yeah. So we look at this as there are really two tracks, right? There's two separate pathways. They can be walked separately or concurrently. But for a minority of companies, the most important thing that they can do is decarbonize. I think right now that is still the most critical challenge that we're facing, biodiversity loss as well, but climate change as maybe the more short-term threat. And so for companies that are, I would say, in the business of making, moving, or mining things, this kind of decarbonization and optimizing processes is really the most important thing for them to do. And that begins by just taking actions, right? Like trying to support that kind of R&D that enables your process to be decarbonized, buying green electricity, like all of these kind of simple things, reduce waste. I mean, not simple. The advice is simple. Actually doing it is hard. Yep. But for many companies, that's really, I think, the step one. Now, for, I would say, the majority of companies, maybe 65-70% of companies that are not really in the business of what we call like making, moving, or mining, which means these are companies that don't have a massive environmental footprint, and they don't have a very adverse impact on the world. And that includes most digital organizations, media, most consultings, most service organizations. So they have an impact on the world, but it's actually, in terms of like, if you just look at their carbon emissions, it's actually quite small, right? And if they're only focusing on this reduce, reuse, recycle, the kind of that do less bad, then I think they're missing an opportunity, and they're also kind of shirking their responsibility. And I think especially those companies should focus on the creation of positive impact and then figuring out, how do we monetize this creation of positive impact so that it actually makes sense from a for-profit perspective. And the key challenge there for the vast majority of, I would say, like investments in nature, is that they're not profitable.
And
the returns are very unclear. And if there's a returns at all, right? Yeah. There's no market right now for coral restoration. There is no market for it. There's no real market for biodiversity protection. There are carbon credits that you can potentially gain speculative gains from, and so. So if you just look at the return on the underlying asset as the way to earn your money, nature is not going to be invested in. And so the return needs to come from the improvement in engagement, right? So what we call engagement ROI. And that's really a new way of thinking. And every company can do this, right? We've seen examples in so many different sectors where integrating, let's say, the planting of a tree or the restoring of a coral or the removal of a kilo of plastic from the ocean, or providing access to education, right? But integrating some kind of tokenized benefit into your interactions with your customers or your employees changes your relationship with those stakeholders. And it is that improved engagement that is extremely valuable. And that is applicable to any company.
So for example, if I understand you well, I could say to my clients when they buy my coaching services that part of the revenue will be used to replant trees. Is that what you're saying?
Something like this, right? So for a service provider, you could say like, okay, this is going to be part of what we do, or I'm going to give you an impact voucher, and you're going to be able to choose something that you care about. I will finance it, and you will have access to the digital assets that come from that impact creation process. Like you're planting trees, you'll have access to videos and photos and so, And that basically gives you the digital assets that enable you to re-engage that customer 6 months from now. Say, hey, remember, we did this work together.
Yeah.
Here are some pictures from the trees because you ended up choosing this project, or you ended up supporting this school, and like, here are some pictures. And so it gives you that ability to re-engage with purpose. Say like, hey, I'm just sharing this. You've actually enabled this. So in a B2B relationship, that often makes sense. We're also seeing this now, for instance, with another client. So they are trying to get their customers to use a new digital tool that they developed. And they've been trying for a year and have not been very successful. And so now they've come to us and say, like, let's partner. And we're going to basically incentivize customers to do exactly what we want them to do. But we're going to give them impact vouchers. And we'll see. And we're going to roll this out in the next couple of weeks. We'll see how that's going to work. And if it indeed leads to an increase from almost zero now, but if it gets to like 5 or 10% of their customers actually doing this, they're trying out this new tool, that's a big success for them. That's really what they're hoping to achieve. And then the cost in terms of impact is actually quite small, because what they want to have is kind of strengthen their customer relationship. And we are a partner to enable them to do this, while at the same time, they can learn and they can figure out, okay, this partner, they choose, or this client, they picked this project, this client picks a different project. So you learn what they care about, which might be very useful for future engagements as well. So that's really, yeah, this is how we see many of these, this kind of engagement ROI kind of manifests in those ways. Plus, you can also see, like, yeah, you get an impact voucher, people redeem it, they post it on social media, it creates additional attention. So there is all of these positive business outcomes that can come from using impact to kind of change your relationships. We see a lot of potential for growth there, but it is a new thing and many companies are not familiar with it. And as a consequence, the buyer persona is still hard to figure out, like, who is the right buyer.
Absolutely. But it, like you said, it does make sense. I like this approach. Also, I guess on a personal level, it makes people feel good.
Again, in for very small scale businesses, like small consultancies, that personal feel good level is actually very important. We've seen this also with a client now in the recruiting space, and they do this per placement. Right? So they're basically per placement. They're enabling the company as well as the person placed to make a choice to create something good. And it kind of bonds the relationship between those three actors, right? And it's the recruiter the external recruiter that might then also 6 months later say, hey, do you have any other recruiting needs, by the way? Here are some updates from this project. And it is about like getting known in the market also for doing this. And that might also then attract new customers. But so I think there are these positive virtuous cycles that you can create through this, but you just need to be willing to try it and then see how it works.
I like it. I will consider it for my business, actually.
Awesome.
Yeah. No, it does make sense at all, because then I will have also the impression to participate somehow, because sometimes I feel like I can't do anything, you know?
And that is the big challenge, I think, with lots of the narrative in sustainability that focuses on footprint, that focuses on negative impact, is that people feel incredibly disempowered, right?
Yeah.
If you want to do something by virtue of your business, well, yeah, it can be in the advice you give to companies, but your ability to kind of do something on your own that kind of reduces your negative impact in the world because it's very small as a consulting or as an advisor, then it's like, well, there's nothing I can do. It is disempowering. And then you see all of this kind of scaremongering and all of the negative news about like what is going on in the world. And you feel like, well, it's, I'm concerned, but I don't feel like I know what to do. So we're giving a very simple answer. Like, you can do something that potentially helps your business grow, that improves your relationships with your stakeholders. And yeah, and that should be very easy. And again, it's something that every company in theory in the world can do, which I think is very important, because most companies or most business leaders that want to do something, but if they're only aware of the kind of old approach to sustainability, which focuses on let's do less bad, most say like, well, there's nothing we can do. We're too small. We don't have enough negative impact. We can't influence our supply chain. Or, yeah, we could do this, but it's prohibitively expensive and it's going to take 50 years to pay up. So, but focusing on something good, bite size, is easy. Everyone can do it.
Love it. Take all your experience, both as a professor and as a startup co-founder, what is the one practical recommendation that you would give to other entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs?
I'd have to go back to something as kind of basic as passion. Right? You, if you're starting your business or you're planning to start your business, you better be sure you absolutely love what you're going to do. Because running a business from 0 to 1 and then from 1 to 100 is hard. It's a lot of work. It's long hours. It's, yeah, it's really challenging, not only on yourself, but also on the people that you're close to, right? It comes with a lot of sacrifice. So yeah, you got to have very high passion, because otherwise it's so hard, I think, to sustain the energy levels that you need in order to succeed. And the other thing is probably also that recognizes that you're not an expert in everything, right? The faster you can, especially I think as a founder, the faster you can let go of specific sets of tasks and like, I'm not even going to be involved in this anymore. I'm going to trust somebody else to do this.
Yeah.
That's very important. And that's also something that academics really struggle with, because they're, by and large, they're lone wolves working on papers with either on their own or with people with very, very similar training, and where kind of things are done together and you kind of maintain perfect oversight of every step of the academic research writing process, which is very different from when you're running a business where you basically have to try to let go of as many things as possible so that you trust other people to do their job. So yeah, so that may be two answers to the question then.
Amazing. Thank you. Last question, how can people contact you?
I'm here. So yeah, I mean, my email, simon@handprint.tech. We're on LinkedIn, where we're very active. We're also currently doing a crowd equity fundraise in the US. So if people have a US bank account and want to support us, they can go to wefunder.com/handprint.tech.
I can actually do it outside the US because I'm a funder. I'm a funder in WeFunder.
Okay, an accredited investor. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, any accredited investor. So,
yes.
So yeah, that's another way to reach us. And then our website, of course, handprint.tech, has a lot of information there about what we do. And then there's other podcasts. But email and LinkedIn are really the main forms. And I know my last name is very hard to write, but if it appears in the show notes, it should be able,
yes,
you should be able to find me on LinkedIn.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much, Simon, for your time today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Loa, for having me.
And thank you for listening. If you found this episode useful, then you're going to love this. I've put together a free online assessment that I call the Bottleneck Index. You answer a series of key questions around your working habits, and it gives you your bottleneck score along with some practical recommendations on how to thrive as an entrepreneur. You'll find the link in the show notes. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.